A new report indicates there are not enough supports available, particularly to new dads. The Being Dad report, published by the Childhood Development Initiative, found work commitments, a lack of information and a lack of supports for dads creates a barrier to caregiving. Joined on the line now by the author of that report, Celine Moran. She's Child Development Initiative Parenting Specialist. Celine, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara. Thanks for having me on the show.
Delighted to do so. How men father has changed drastically, perhaps more in the last 20 or 30 years than it had in the two or three centuries before that.
Yes, absolutely. And that came very much across from the dads that we worked with. And really that, you know, society's, I suppose, expectations of the role of fathers and the role that they play in the lives of their children has really changed dramatically, I suppose, over the last two decades.
And a keynote part of that change is the concept of caregiving by fathers as an end in itself rather than an adjunct to that which may be given by the mother or primary carer.
Yes. And I suppose what we're really calling for is really, and, you know, what the dads who took part in the research really want is to be able to be equal caregivers of their children. You know, because I suppose we know a lot of, you know, mothers as well are in full-time work, you know, so there needs to be, I suppose, that, shared and equal caregiving for children. But I suppose what they're finding is that a lot of the information and supports are not really geared towards dads, and in some cases not really available for them. So while they really want to be more involved and more engaged, I suppose there's a lot of expectations from society that they need to be now. Mm. It's a bit like the supports then aren't there for them to kind of, you know, make that leap, if you like, or that transition.
It's interesting that the point that you make about the expectation of society that dads be more active and more 50-50 in their caregiving role as parents, when still culturally you will hear an awful lot of people saying, oh, you know, Martin is babysitting the children, they're his own children, or duration of paternity leave is so much shorter than compared to maternity leave or new parent leave. An awful lot of our language still seeks to disempower men in fatherhood.
Yeah, and that is a big factor as well for men. You know, it's that kind of, as you call it, that discourse that's really there, kind of reinforcing those really traditional roles around mothering and fathering, if you like. You know, that the mother will be the primary caregiver and the father will be the breadwinner. And that's kind of really, you know, all of this is kind of making it kind of very confusing, I think, as well. So suppose we're kind of calling for more discussion around that, you know, and to really kind of move those, you know, to create a shift. And we're talking about, you know, bringing that in for children and young people, you know, so that, you know, so that kind of shifts that pervasive kind of perception around gender equality in relation to caring roles. Mm.
Because ultimately it damages, and I use that term lightly, every member of a family if all of the caregiving is lumped onto one person while the other person who actively wants a role in that feels that they're taking a back seat for structural issues, for cultural issues, for societal issues, when everybody could benefit.
Yes, and I suppose, you know, we're kind of calling, you know, to kind of, you know, include and acknowledge and support dads, because really that's a benefit for everybody, the whole family. Because I suppose what we're seeing happening and what the dads have told us is, you know, despite the fact, you know, when maybe the baby is born and they're trying to stay ahead and up with the same level of knowledge as say, the mom of the baby, as time goes by, they've just told us that they're just not able to keep up. A lot of the information is geared towards mothers. It's more accessible. Women access WhatsApp groups, say, for instance, that would have came up in the report more easily. So I kind of, the message to them is kind of, in a way, you keep to the sidelines in a way. And the other difficulty is that mothers can really become overburdened then as well.
And that creates then a spiral of conflict.
Yes. And I mean, you know, I suppose like that, it's not empowering men, and yet it's placing too much of a burden on women as well. You know, whether it's down to, you know, in the hospital, men, you know, maybe not being involved as much to, you know, later on when children start school, to primarily been the mother always the contact from the school, you know, so it is to try and shift those things now, on.
One of the key parts of the report, Celine, is the call for formal and informal supports and interventions. What manner should the manner and form should they take?
Yeah, and I suppose we are working, we're continuing to work with this group of dads, you know, to see really what they like, you know, because they have felt and they've told us that, you know, there is, and they've seen their wives or partners, you know, benefit from supports that are out there, but then feel, you know, some of them went to baby massage, different things, and just felt completely, you know, excluded. And, you know, sometimes that's an internal thing as well. But, you know, so there is a piece of work around that, you know, creating kind of spaces just for fathers and dads. But then there is maybe for some men find it difficult to reach out as well, you know, which would be something that does happen generally in men's health. So, you know, really, I suppose, to look at what supports are there, to talk to men and find out what they would like, what is helpful for them, what they engage with, but then to also encourage them around the benefits of peer support, I suppose, from other dads.
Well, Celine Moran, Child Development Initiative Parenting Specialist and author of the report Being Dad, thank you indeed for joining us.
Anthony, Jack Lambert, Professor of Infectious Diseases at UCD, says we have to accept that COVID-19 is with us for the long haul and people will continue to die. He says that the message that all restrictions will end next month is not right, but we have to live with this virus. Would you take the same stance?
I would. I think we've chosen as a species that we're going to tolerate this virus circulating, and that has some consequences. And the trick is to reduce the consequences. And the main things we can do are obviously, first of all, to vaccinate everybody on the planet. This is a very nasty pathogen. And the more widespread vaccination will save an awful lot of lives, because the majority of deaths are now occurring in less developed countries with vaccination rates which are very, very low. And we need to fix that.
Anthony, we know that Ireland's rate of vaccination is very high. We know on the 22nd of October that restrictions are lifting. Things like nightclubs are going to be opened. Would you advise people who have spent the past 18 months, no matter what your age, inside, you know, socially distancing, you know, isolating in general, who now want to go back out, socialise, attend nightclubs, would you be advising people to do so?
I think it depends on the level of infection. What we've argued for from the beginning of this is that we control the level of infection as far down as is possible, and then get on with our lives with, you know, whatever level of precaution it's necessary to keep it down. And at the moment, the level of infection is relatively high. So there are certain risks. You minimise those risks by being vaccinated. You minimise those risks by people being sensible. And if they have symptoms, as the vast majority of people do, not going out. You know, if you feel you might be unwell, don't stay home. Don't spread whatever it is you've got, be it COVID or flu or a cold or whatever. Don't spread it around. I would suggest that we continue for some time at least wearing masks in public transport, particularly if it's very crowded, and also wearing masks in schools for much the same reasons.
Yeah. You mentioned flu there. Who would you advise to receive the flu vaccination this winter?
I think people should be very open to getting the vaccination this winter. Flu vaccination, unfortunately, isn't as good as the COVID-19 vaccines, but it does have an impact. It does reduce your risk of dying substantially. Certainly older people who are anyway immunocompromised, there are suggestions of expanding the coverage of flu vaccine, but I'm not familiar with where those suggestions are at now. But I would say if you're offered it, take it.
Schools, we know that primary school children from Monday no longer have to isolate, and there's no longer contact tracing and testing if they are a close contact of a positive case of COVID-19. Is that going to help the reopening of this country, or is it going to hinder it and we potentially be back in some sort of lockdown in the Christmas period or the winter season, I should say? Because as we know, when winter does come, windows do close. We know ventilation is key with this virus.
I think the first thing to say is I really hope not. I said in May of last year that I thought this virus would be under control by Christmas of this year, and I'm really hoping to be right. But yes, it does increase the risk. Not looking at what's going on doesn't stop it going on. I mean, Paul Reed said that we're moving on from measuring COVID to managing COVID, which raises the question of how do you plan to manage COVID unless you measure it? We measure other things. We measure TB, we measure measles, we measure chickenpox, we measure 70 or 80 other diseases routinely. Why is COVID magic? We don't need to measure it and we can just pretend it's not there.
Obviously, you're an expert in public health. You yourself, do you feel confident now going out and about, attending restaurants? Would say if you were somebody who wanted to frequent a nightclub, would you feel comfortable now come the 22nd of October to get life to, well, back to pre-pandemic ways in many aspects?
I think one of the things that infectious disease teaches you is that life never goes back. I remember when HIV hit Ireland in the 80s and it changed sexual activity for a very long time. And it really hasn't changed back. These viruses change how we behave. You see this in other parts of the world where, say, malaria is common, where things like dengue fever are common. They change how people behave because nobody wants to get them. And COVID will change how we behave. The less COVID there is, the less impact it will have. You know, dengue fever does not change how we behave because we have hardly any cases and they're all imported. But COVID, unfortunately, is here. So I don't know how it will change. I don't go to nightclubs, but I probably wouldn't if I did. I will certainly be looking for less crowded restaurants. I will be seeking to eat in places that are essentially outdoors but sheltered. And I think that may be, I think that's no harm. I think it's been a long-term part of life in many other countries and it's been absent here and it's now available here. So people quite like it. It can be very pleasant. But I think that's what people will choose.
Okay, well, Professor Anthony Staines, Professor of Health Systems at the School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health at DCU. Thanks for the time.
Ciara, thank you very much indeed.
Voters in Berlin have sent a very clear message on their opinions on mass ownage of apartments and homes by single entities. Voters backed a non-binding referendum that could see around 240,000 apartments, around 11% of the total in that city, taken back by local government. Again, it is non-binding. And I know that Dr. Rory Hearn, Assistant Professor of Social Policy at Maynooth University, says there are legal issues surrounding any such potential move, and it's unlikely to be able to be picked up and transplanted here. But to get the view from Berlin, from a trainee barrister at the King's Inns, I'm joined on the line now by Hugo Mills. Hugo, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much indeed.
The referendum, as we've noted, non-binding. It passed by 56 and some odd percent. Were you there during the vote?
Well, I was there on the day. I wasn't able to vote myself because only citizens are allowed to vote and citizens who are resident in Berlin. But I'm obviously, as a European citizen, allowed to vote in local elections. So I did take part in the vote and I was there for the celebrations afterwards, yes.
And were there celebrations? Was this considered a victory by some?
Absolutely. But well, by many, 86% of Berlin's population are renters. And as you said, nearly 60% of people voted for this measure. It's very, very popular. So there were celebrations. This campaign has been going on for just over 3 years. You know, it didn't come out of nowhere. It's highly organized. There are many, many people involved. There's something like 25,000 followers on Twitter. et cetera, et cetera. It's very, very popular, and there were absolutely organised celebrations on the Sunday evening and, well, all the way through the night.
And the campaign seems to be specifically targeted to the owners, most of them companies, of a certain number of properties and above. This seems to be quite significant, 3,000 or more apartments, which in an Irish context sounds absolutely vast, but in a German context is probably a middle-sized property ownership company.
No, actually, they're pretty well tailored. First of all, you said most of them companies. Actually, all of them are companies. So it's only targeting publicly listed companies with a property portfolio of more than 3,000 homes. So it's really very large. It's not going to be targeting, you know, individual landlords or even significant landlords with maybe 20 or 30 properties, the kind of people that you and I would consider to be pretty big landlords. No, this was very much focused on the massive corporations that really do own vast swaths of the housing stock in this city. And so that's why, all in all, if they're all included in this measure, it represents nearly a quarter of a million homes, which is 11%, as you said, of the housing stock. So this isn't just for mid-sized or ordinary companies. This is really very much focused on large individual corporations that have, over the past number of decades, and particularly in the east of Berlin, the former German Democratic Republic, have really done a great deal to swipe up as much of the homes and housing stock as they possibly could, and now are kind of inflating the rents because not much is being built by them to mitigate the demand.
Aren't there rent controls or de facto rent controls in effect in Berlin?
There are some, but not as many as you might think. The environment is a bit different to what we'd know in Ireland, and that probably wouldn't be surprising given how much of the population and how many of the voters are themselves renters. So, for example, it is perfectly possible to de facto be kind of a permanent renter in a property, given you meet certain demands. Now, certainly if you don't pay your rent, for example, you're no longer protected, but it is not unusual for people to be renting their properties for very, very long term and very, very securely. There are some rent controls, but those go away when properties change hands. And so particularly this is affecting young people, foreigners, young professionals who are moving to Berlin because there's obviously a thriving startup and technology scene over here and the art scene as well. So it's kind of resulted in a sort of a two-tier system. Those who have been very long-term in the city and then everyone else, and usually those are young people and foreign people.
Now, the campaign which led to this referendum and its quite resounding result is kind of tagged as resocializing housing in Berlin. But what would it mean in real terms were the referendum binding and acted on?
Yeah, so this is kind of the socializing aspect is what it's called in German, socialization. That relies on Article 15 of the German Constitution. Basically, what that article says is that it is possible for the state to intervene and take hold of land or of homes or of anything really, if it is in direct benefit of the public good. This actually has never been used before. It's never been tested in court. It's never really been deemed necessary until now. And this is the basis for this entire campaign. And it's for that reason that, as Rory Hearn correctly pointed out, it's unlikely to happen immediately that this will go into effect. It will be challenged in the courts by obviously the corporate landlords who are involved and who are affected, and it will probably go all the way up to the Constitutional Court in Germany.
And
so it'll be a number of years.
Would create an enormous litigatory headache, because not only would it take a considerable time for each of the individual companies, were the results of this referendum to be acted on in the way that you've outlined, Hugo, but the individual companies, but I don't know that much about German law, but I would imagine there's a precept that they could also act in concert as well. So conceivably, you could have a case taken by all of them individually and then collectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, at this point, they've been keeping their cards fairly close to their chest. I'm not sure how they plan to do this and That's something that I expect we'll find out more about in the coming months. But at the moment, the majority, ironically, although the majority of Berliners voted for this measure, a majority of Berliners also voted for politicians in their local, for local representatives who are members of parties, particularly the Social Democrats and the Greens, who in the previous few weeks have said that they plan to ignore this decision. So now that there has been such a resounding support, this may change their political calculations. But at the moment, it's not entirely clear.
And I suppose how this unfolds will be watched not only by the people of Germany, but arguably across the rest of Europe and indeed in Ireland.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is quite impressive how much knowledge that the campaigners of the movement, which is known as Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen, the Enteignen movement, are aware of similar campaign movements across Europe. I was surprised when I first went to my first meeting of their campaign. When I said that I was Irish, they immediately started talking about CATU, which is renters union movement in Dublin. They know their stuff. These are not people who are just out of the thin air thinking, well, let's expropriate landlords. They're jurists, they're campaigners, they're people who have done a lot of study, a lot of research. They're very, very committed, not only to their own cause, but also to an idea of solidarity with other people across Europe, because they know, and you and I both know, that this is a problem that's, affecting people across Europe, across the world, in cities everywhere, because there is a general lack of investment in housing for all, and they're very aware of that.
Well, Hugo Mills, a trainee barrister at the King's Inns, thank you indeed for joining us live from Berlin for that perspective. An urgent review is being conducted into allegations of sexism, bullying, sexual assault and rape by some members of the Defence Forces following claims made by the women of Honour Group in those keynote RTE radio documentaries. And writing extensively on this matter in today's Irish Independent is defence and security analyst Declan Power, who joins me now on the line. Declan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
Your perspective on this particular set of circumstances and this particular culture within elements of the Defence Forces is quite unique. You were a soldier yourself for many years and served alongside some of the Women of Honour.
I did, yes. Yeah, I trained alongside Yvonne O'Rourke when she was undergoing her cadetship training in the Curragh, and later encountered CQMS Karina Malloy when she was quartermaster sergeant in charge of logistics for Defence Headquarters. So, yeah, it kind of hammers home all the more when you actually knew some of the people involved. They're not just faceless statistics. And I think the important thing to take out of this is, well, as I say in the article, for a start, I thought the worst of this had been dealt with. And that, based on when Tom Clonan, who has served with the DFHQ, brought his research out in a PhD thesis he did for DCU. And actually, it had been done with a view to helping the Defence Forces. But the aftermath of that was badly managed and was an unseemly row. But the positives were that new structures were brought into the Defence Forces in terms of not just about management of women, but management of people that bullying and abuse could not take place in the same way. But what the documentary, Katie Hannan's excellent documentary, brings out is there was a spectrum of things happening. Some of these things that are talked about happened probably back around the time Tom's research led to reform. But other things are brought to the fore, particularly when Yvonne O'Rourke, a retired captain, talked about her life as a junior officer, being in a socialist setting where a senior officer targeted her at a bar. Now, whatever came out of it is sort of unclear, because as she talks herself, she woke up in a setting where she wasn't too sure what happened. But the point is, it shouldn't have happened in the first place. And this is my key point I wanted to get across, that to prevent this happening, it's not about just dealing with it from a regulatory point of view. Cultural aspects have to shift gears a bit in the Defence Forces.
I don't think it's arguably, Declan, because culture, you can change all the internal structures in any organisation or any group of people all that you like, but if there is no cultural change, there will be no particular change in the manner in which people comport themselves. And cultural change is the hardest to achieve.
It is. And cultural change can only happen when you take acknowledge that there needs to be cultural change and don't be defensive about it. I mean, I think the problem is a lot of people, particularly men of my generation, would have looked at, you know, women askance when they came into the army and saw them as incompatible and incongruous to military life. The reality, and part of that wasn't just our socialization and the way we looked at male-female identity and gender roles. Part of that was contributed to by the military authorities and the governments of the day, who were obsessed with the idea of optics. So when women came in, the box was ticked, and every time there was a unit that had women going overseas, the women would be photographed. But they weren't taking into account the granular reality of women's participation and existence within military life. And here's the thing, I discussed this recently with a very good friend of mine who served as an officer in our special forces, and he was of the opinion too about the cultural aspect. And he said the point was, we sort of ticked the box and said, well, now women are in, and so we're going to treat them just like little men, and everybody's going to be fine because everybody's equal now, and they'll do all the same training and all the same things. And there was a lot of accommodations made, in a sense. And when I say accommodations, Stephanie Guzman wrote a book in the States called A Kinder, Gentler Military. And initially, she's a feminist academic, and she wanted to criticize the military for not integrating fast enough. And instead, she ended up writing a book criticizing both the government and military for not taking enough care and cognizance that women are women and men are men, and how you integrate them, how you assimilate them has to be given a little bit of thought. And that if you get that right, then you also address issues of other groupings and minorities. Because let's face it, the military is always going to be a sort of a male-dominated culture. But that doesn't mean, when I say it doesn't have to be male-dominated. You have to create a rigorous, robust warrior culture. But that doesn't have to be done at the expense of trying to turn women into men. And then when that doesn't happen, kind of pretending that it all has, and then brushing under the carpet inconvenient stories about women who have been abused because that can't happen because they're all equal on paper. But the reality is that will always happen unless you achieve one key thing, and that is the assimilation of all people who join up, who meet the requirements, who go through the training. And if that happens, then they become comrades. And if you have a comrade in a platoon, whether it's a woman, whether it's a person of a different ethnicity to you or whatever else, you shouldn't see that first. What you should see is the comrade that you respect because they went through the necessary training. And that, and for that to happen, it requires leaders, particularly at the junior officer and sergeant level, to ensure that they lead by example, and that there's positive reinforcement rather than negative reinforcement. Still, that there's rigor, the necessary rigor to produce combat effective soldiers, but that doesn't have to be achieved by being Neanderthals. And that we get our heads, that we think our way through this.
Do you have any confidence, Declan, in the manner and tone and potential effectiveness of this review into these allegations, given that historically and perhaps in many sectors of the Defence Forces today, it views itself as a monolith? You know, soldiers are this kind, one kind of person, and our instinct is to protect power.
Well, to be honest, I don't think the people in the organisation view themselves as a monolith. And I think the organisation has been making moves to shift gears about that. I think there's a commission on the future of the Defence Forces in play at the moment. And I hope that they take on board the fact that there are chances for a modern redrafting of a Defence Forces that meets the both domestic and international needs of Ireland's defence arrangements. We're a small country. We rely on partner nations for a variety of things, economically, politically, and indeed defensively. And that we create a defence force that's agile, mobile, that's able to think its way out of problems as well as fight its way out of problems. Now, we have been growing that organically from the bottom up. So my faith in the defence forces in dealing with this is in the new generation of soldier, male, female, different ethnicities, whatever else. And what we, my generation, who are in the leadership roles now, need to be doing is creating, taking on board the opinions and ideas and creating, they are helping to facilitate the creation of the mechanisms for new training of new generations. Now, one of the things that has come out of this that's positive is that the current Minister of Defence, Simon Coveney, has agreed that the women at the heart of those allegations, that they will have a voice in this new review. And I'm heartened to hear that, because a review that doesn't take into account the people at the centre of it is damned to go nowhere. And I've already seen the negative response to the review on the Jadaval affair and the issue about decorations, that while at its heart had some very authentic and accurate points to make, but alienated a lot of people in the family because it didn't really take into account things from a cultural and a political perspective as well as a military perspective. Now, I think that the lesson may have been learnt with regards to this review. Mm. Bring in external experts from big militaries like the US, the UK, Australian and others who have been through this on a broader basis, and also match that with women who have lived experience. And maybe not just women either, because the great thing, if I could use that term, about what the Women of Honour has brought out, is that abuse is abuse and bullying is bullying, no matter who's at the end of it. It was probably at its starkest with regards to women because they were such a new thing for the defence forces. But there's a lot of positives. I think that a lot of the new generation of service people throughout the Army, Navy and Air Corps have that sense of common team approach, and we need to institutionalize it properly, not just let it work from the ground up. The guidance has to come from the top down in a real way, not an obsession with 12% improvement of 12% recruitment of women or optics, but a granular reality has to come about from this.
Well, Declan Power, unfortunately time is against us, but Declan Power, defense and security analyst, thank you indeed for joining us and being so generous with your time.
So the government's statement that a new bank holiday will be announced on the 12th of October has gotten people quite excited. Us here in County Kildare, we obviously have special ties to St. Bridget, and a lot of people are saying that St. Bridget's Day, the 1st of February, should be the new bank holiday. One of those people is joining me now, Melanie Lynch, founder and chief executive of Her Story. How are you?
I'm wonderful, thank you.
Tell us, why do you think it should be St. Bridget's Day?
Oh, for so many reasons. That's the thing about Bridget. You just can't put her in a box. She's so multifaceted. And I think it'd be a big win for Kildare. Myself, my mother and my grandmother are Kildare women. So I've heard all about Bridget since I was a little nipper. And all the wonderful stories. Jesus, there's no limit to who she is and who she was. I think there's also two really important connections that we need to make in this time. She was an Ulster goddess and a Leinster saint. So she's actually an all-Ireland, all-Ireland icon, which could be a wonderful healing day for the whole island. And I actually remember being interviewed on UTV last year on Pamela's show and sharing this with the people of Northern Ireland because they weren't aware that she was an Ulster goddess. And she was also a pan-European goddess. She was celebrated all across Europe from Turkey to Spain. So this could become the new EU bank holiday. And I think in a time when Brexit has threatened the stability of the EU, you have to remember it's one of the most successful peace projects in modern history. And I think it's very important that we reaffirm our commitment to the EU and to its founding values. So it's a great time to come together with our EU neighbours and to celebrate and to honour.
You're mentioning an All-Ireland holiday. We know in particular, if we think about Christmas, we hear about Boxing Day over in the UK. You know, you see the ads on TV, the Boxing Day sales. So on the 26th of December, we honour St. Stephen. And on the 17th of March, we honour St. Patrick. Obviously, Jesus gets his big day on the 25th of December. But the women are left out. No surprise.
I know, like, we have to change the story, and the time is now to do it. You know, to think that we're now in the year 2021 and we don't have a national holiday dedicated to a single woman, and also Manon Aaron, you know, we really deserve it at this stage. And there's no question about it. Bridget is our matron saint, and she's our, and if you think about it, like, I suppose from the context of St. Patrick, like, he's celebrated worldwide, not just in Ireland. And we don't even have a national holiday for our matron saint, you know. And I think, you know, if you look at the stories of Bridget as well, like, she trumps Patrick outright. Like, she's just such a badass.
Yeah, and she
breaks all the rules. She's like, what rule book? I can be an abortionist, I can be a lesbian, I can co-found an abbey and run it side by side in complete equality, men and women. The early Christian church actually was very progressive, and she was an incredibly brilliant leader aside Conleth. They ran a, you know, really beautiful monastery and an abbey, and it was, yeah, egalitarian times. You know, we've much to remember, much to learn from her time.
Us here at KFM Radio, the birthday of KFM Radio is the 1st of February, and yes, there you go, that's no coincidence, obviously. KFM and St. Bridget's so closely linked, but we know how great Bridget is, or we hope our listeners know how great Bridget is. But spring itself, right? You come out of Christmas, you know, Christmas is such a flurry, you're doing so much, you've so many plans. Come January, let's be real, it's a bleak month, it's grey, it's dull, it's cold, and nothing is going on, really. Sorry to those who are born in January. And February 1st is the perfect time, I guess, to have some sort of refresh and take that little bit of time off and prepare yourself for the next season. And I guess that in itself would be so helpful to everyone.
Of course, yes. So if you look to ancient Ireland, the Celts, they honoured the festival of Imbolc. It was the festival of the goddess, the 1st of February. And they knew the importance of planting new seeds, metaphorical and literal, to herald in the new season, but also the return of the light. It's very important that as we you know, we're emerging from winter, that we take a moment to honour that. Turning, you know, return of the light and the renewing of spirits and the renewal of energy, I suppose, and optimism. And I think there's a funny thing in Ireland as well. You know, if you look at our calendar, like, it's like this dark void between New Year's Day and St. Patrick's Day. Nothing happens. So like from talking to Fáilte Ireland, like, this is a great time to bring tourists to Ireland. It's a great time to increase revenue and to really lift the public spirits too. It's a no-brainer. I mean, I don't understand the argument of doing a national holiday in November. That makes no sense to me. You're already in the run-up to Christmas. We don't need one in September because, sure, look, it's still nearly summer. We're getting Indian summer. When we need it, actually, is it's late winter going into spring, because, like, the weather in Ireland doesn't really lift till Patrick's Day and beyond. Yeah. I often got a sunburn on Patrick's Day.
So did I, geez, yeah.
Those months in January from February, like, we need a lift of spirits, you know?
Yeah, no.
And we need to come together as a people, like, because we need to plant new seeds, and we also need to acknowledge the new spring that Ireland is going through. Like, we're emerging as one of the most progressive egalitarian countries in the world. It's an amazing opportunity and really to come together and to plant new seeds and to, I think, to renew our sense of optimism and how far we've come as a nation and what's possible, you know, what you can do in one generation. It was a country for no women. Ireland was, you know, so far behind the times, and now we're a world leader for equality. And I think Bridget's Day would just be the perfect marker, because I loved the philosophy of Bridget as she's the triple archetypal goddess of fire and water, masculine and feminine, perfect balance. And in Eastern tradition, that's thought as the yin yang, famously in the Tao.
Oh, yes.
But that's Bridget, that's who she is. So she's feminine, but she knows how to wield her fire, and she knows how to temper her fire with water. And I think, you know, in times where we can be very divisive and easily triggered, she's a great archetype in teaching how to master our emotions and how to really alchemize. And that's, I suppose, that's how I did her story. Like, I'd have to be brutally honest. Like, I mean, it was founded on feminist rage. I took that rage and I started the Her Story light show because I needed to alchemize that. We needed to create a celebratory, inclusive, you know, honoring of women on the 1st of February.
Have you any idea which way the government will sway? Obviously, we saw the other day Fine Gael put out a poll, I guess, a public poll about how they feel about the November bank holiday. And it seems, by and large, the public reaction is what you've just said a few minutes ago. It's in the lead up to Christmas and we don't need another break in November. And it seems, again, the majority, especially, this is me looking through social media, obviously, are going for St. Bridget's Day. Have you any idea what the government are thinking?
Yes, we've contacted every single TD and senator on the island. We did an initial call out actually on the spring equinox back in March, and we're doing it again as of yesterday. And the response already has been amazing from TDs and senators. And the Cian Cahorla, he's back the campaign now. He's on to Leo straight away. So let's see how it evolves over the coming days. But I think we need to really, it needs deep thought actually. It's not, I know there's a lot of funny ideas about what day it should be and stuff, but it actually needs a bit of deep thought, because look what St. Patrick's Day has done to Ireland, for Ireland and for the world. you know, the whole world lights up green on St. Patrick's Day. It's the colour of the heart chakra. It's and it's a a reaffirming of Christian values. And I think we could do something really powerful. I don't think this is an opportunity to be trivial and flippant. I think also you've got to be careful with something like a commemoration of the pandemic. There's still a lot of trauma and a lot of suffering. And I think it's important to alchemize that and to heal that.
Melanie Lynch, founder and chief executive of Her Story. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.